Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, let's take a little trip over to an Italian village that has learned to love its bears. By learning to live with its ursine neighbors, mountainous Pettorano sul Gisio has drawn tourists and new residents, bucking a trend of rural decline.
Are they just feeding the tourists the bears like this?
Not nearly as sinister, at least for now, but it's a medieval mountain town. It has tons of alleys and wooden doors that are locked sometime in the last century because the lower parts of town have been very abandoned. We've got branches growing out of walls, roofs that have fallen in, agrarian urban decay, if such a thing can be said. But it's listed as one of Italy's Association of Historic Towns. In 1920, about 5,000 people lived here. The population today, 390. And this is not an isolated case. This is similar to many others in Italy's south central Abruzzo region. It's home to a shrinking, aging population. One nearby town has almost been completely abandoned and has only 12 people left. But this particular town is a little different than some of its other abandoned neighbors, in part because it has a passion for bears. Not only does it have a life-size model of a brown bear and cub in the town square, it's got paintings of bears looking down from walls as they're affixed. At dawn and dusk, a bear known as Barbara is known to wander the narrow streets, sometimes trailed by cubs, to see if she can pilfer any food. And because of that, it has attracted a crowd of younger people who are working in nature restoration. But making peace with the town's critically endangered Marsican or Apennine bears, which are endemic to the region, it wasn't really easy to kind of forge this alliance at first. And about 10 years ago, relations were at their worst. This was during the reign of Peppina, a 135-kilogram problem bear, that was in quotes, who raised cubs in the areas for several years. And she was known for her raids on people's chickens, their bees, their orchards. She would hoover up any food she could find.
I mean, they should have just put out some picnic baskets.
I'm telling you.
Sorry, that's a very old reference.
Our culture had, you know, cartoon training, so
right.
There's a YouTube opportunity for Italy here. But in 2014, tensions between local people and the animals came to a head when a young male bear was shot by a hobby farmer after it raided a chicken coop. Now, at the time, people supported the man who claimed he was attacked by the bear. There are no documented cases of Marsican bears killing humans, but there was a climate at the time which was anti-bear, basically. What happened with the bear's death, though, created a paradigm shift. They realized they had to do something in a more practical way, because shooting things that threaten you, that's the American way, not the Italian way, right? So in 2015, Pettorano sul Gisio became the first bear-smart community in Italy. They erected electric fences around more than 100 properties to protect the bees, chickens, and other farm animals they didn't want raided. They added gates and bear-proof bins. They even distributed manuals on how best to live alongside bears. If there's any ripe fruit, pick it off the ground in the orchards. Any food waste is kept indoors until the rubbish is collected. And by 2017, there had been a 99% reduction in bear raids, according to data from Salviamo l'Orso, which is a bear conservation organization, who also says there have been no damages since 2020. And the success of this is getting other European countries to take note. There are now 18 bear smart communities across Europe funded by the EU's Life Environmental Program. And even though depopulation may have drawn bears to the region, now the bears are bringing back the people. One of the owners of Il Torchio restaurant, Amelina Cicciolella, describes the rewilding events as a real lifesaver in economic terms. So much so that her restaurant now offers vegetarian food on their once meat-dominated daily menu so that the nature-loving tourists have food that they can eat. Mario Finocchi, president of the Vallaluna Cooperative Society, says there is an increasing trend in the presence of tourists in the area. Some people who came as tourists decided to buy a house. The number of tourists staying in the town has increased from about 250 in 2020 to over 2,400 last year.
Wow.
There's a new young community that have come because of the Bears who are working on socially and culturally enriching the town. It's not just about tourism. It's about making people believe they can remain here and have a very good life.
And electrocuting bears.
No. Dissuading bears. Just dissuading
bears. Right. I'm sure it doesn't kill them. It's just a little zap that says, I don't go here.
It's a discouragement. But peaceable relations between species? Who knows? Dogs and cats living together? Totally anarchy.
That's right.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from space.com. It's titled, Could We Use Black Holes to Power Future Human Civilizations? Quote, there is no limitation to extracting the enormous energy from a rotating black hole.
I mean, in conjunction with the other article where we might be in a black hole, I don't know that I love that. What if someone's sucking our energy out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can think of at least one limitation.
Right.
But research author Jorge Pinochet of the Metropolitan University of Educational Sciences told Space.com, in an important article written in 1969, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Roger Penrose speculated on the possibility that an ancient civilization could extract energy from a rotating black hole. Obviously, black holes aren't the only objects that rotate, but there is something very special about rotating black holes or Kerr black holes that isn't true for other spinning cosmic bodies. Kerr black holes are capable of spinning at speeds close to the speed of light in a vacuum. As they spin, the immense gravitational influence of Kerr black holes drag the very fabric of space around with them in a process called frame dragging, or the Lenz-Thuring effect, named after the physicists who first proposed it, Joseph Lenz and Hans Thuring. So, a rotating black hole has rotational kinetic energy, and by pulling space along with it, it imparts its extraordinary rotational energy to the objects in its surroundings. Nature's preferred mechanism to extract black hole energy can be seen in quasars. These are supermassive black holes with masses millions or billions times that of the sun, surrounded by a flattened cloud of swirling gas and dust called an accretion disk. Material that isn't devoured by the black hole can be channeled to its poles by powerful magnetic fields. This matter is blasted out as energetic jets called relativistic jets, one from each pole, and oriented at 90 degrees to the black hole's rotational plane. As a rotating black hole transfers energy to its surroundings, the source of this energy, which is its rotation, is depleted, which means that the black hole spins increasingly slowly. In theory, this process stops when the black hole stops spinning, becoming a static or Schwarzschild black hole. So, could we create black hole batteries? Pinochet explained, perhaps the simplest form of energy extraction would be to directly harness the fantastic radiation emissions just as on Earth we harness the energy radiated by the sun. However, in this case, we are not directly extracting rotational energy, but rather the thermal energy produced by rotation. In his 1969 article, Penrose described a mechanism that could directly utilize rotational energy instead of thermal energy. He suggests imagining a carousel that spins only by inertia, so after it receives an initial push or impulse, it continues spinning even though the motors are off. If a child throws a ball at one of the merry-go-rounds against the direction of the rotation, the ball will bounce back, gaining a higher speed than it initially had. As a result, the carousel will have lost some of its rotational speed, and that means the ball's extra kinetic energy comes from the rotational kinetic energy of the carousel. What Penrose imagined is that we launch a particle against the direction of rotation of a black hole, and a fragment of this particle returns to us with greater energy than the initially launched particle. In other words, we'll have extracted energy from the black hole at the expense of its rotation. Which, if we live inside of these black holes, rude, but if we don't...
You know, it's a particle compared to an entire black hole. The other thing is, This is all like highly theoretical. Maybe we'll get to use it 10,000 years in the future. We're nowhere near getting close enough to a black hole to be shooting particles at it. So, all right, that's fine.
Yeah, but it's so important to call first dibs on the potential power that one could harness from that. Right.
Someone's got to patent it for sure. Mm-hmm. So, all right.
Yeah. We're just, you know, laying the ground for future space hypercapitalism.
Exactly.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link. This comes from Science Alert. Mesokinesia. Phenomenon could affect 1 in 3 people, study shows. So for some of you, or for a lot of you, noticing somebody fidgeting can be distracting, vexing, even excruciating. But why? According to research, the stressful sensation caused by seeing others fidget is incredibly common, affecting 1 in 3 people.
And everyone who comes around me.
Yeah. I think my parents are definitely in that category.
Uh-huh. Called mesokinesia, meaning hatred of movements. This phenomenon hasn't been studied much until recent years, but according to Sumit Jaswal, the psychologist at the University of British Columbia, mesokinesia is defined as a strong negative effect or emotional response to the sight of someone else's small and repetitive movements, such as seeing someone mindlessly fidget with a hand or foot. Across a series of experiments involving over 4,100 participants, the researchers measured the prevalence of mesokinesia in a bunch of university students and people from the general population, assessing the impacts it had upon them and the sensations they might manifest from it. They found that approximately 1/3 self-reported some degree of sensitivity to this repetitive fidgeting. According to the analysis, this is something that goes hand in hand with the sound sensitivity of misophonia, but not always.
Yeah, I wonder to what degree it's like, if you ask somebody, does this bother you? They'd be like, oh, hell yeah, I hate it. But it's not, you know, destroying their lives if they're around somebody fidgeting. I think there is probably a clinical level of it, but you can't ask people to self-diagnose because they're always going to be like, yeah, this is the worst thing ever.
It's like, how much are you being asked to pay attention to it? If you're asked to focus on it, you're going to notice it more. And some people can screen it out and some people are like, no, if you continue to pick at your cuticles, I'm going to flip this table over.
Yeah, yeah. Or this could just be me self-justifying because I am a fidgeter. I fidget constantly. And I know there's some people that they don't want to be around me because of it. I'm like, I get it. I don't blame you, but also I can't stop. So
right, because they mentioned it varies significantly among individuals. Some people reported low sensitivity, where others were highly affected. Another psychologist, Todd Handy, began researching mesokinesia after a partner told him he was a fidgeter and confessed she felt stress when he fidgeted. And as a visual cognitive neuroscientist, this really piqued his interest to find out what was happening in the brain. So the million-dollar question, why do we find it so annoying? In the study, researchers ran tests to see if mesokinesia might originate in heightened visual attention sensitivities, amounting to an inability to block out distracting events. The results based on early experiments were inconclusive on that front, with the researchers finding no firm evidence that reflexive visual attentional mechanisms substantially contributed to mesokinesia sensitivity. While we're still only at the onset of exploring where this may spring from on a cognitive level, the researchers do have some hypothetical leads. One possibility we might want to explore is their mirror neurons are at play. So those are the neurons that activate when we move, but they also activate when we see other move. Or when you see somebody get hurt, you may wince as well. By extension, it's possible that mesokinesia-prone people might be unconsciously empathizing with the fidgeters.
Right. It's a sign of anxiety, so you're kind of picking up on it.
So one thing is for certain, though, from the results seen here, it's clear that this unusual phenomenon is actually more usual than we realized.
Yeah.
So for those of you suffering from it, don't worry, you're not alone. Your challenge is real. Everyone hates those fidgets. Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next one is from futurism.com, and it's got a couple of different elements all coming together in a really unexpected way. So first off, do y'all remember Bodie McBoatface?
Yes.
Yes. Everybody loves Bodie. But for those who don't, back in 2016, the British government commissioned a polar research ship for the tidy sum of £200 million. And in order to raise public awareness and enthusiasm for science, they took nominations and held a public online vote for what the name of this vessel should be, which in itself is just a reminder of how innocent we were in 2016 that anybody thought that was a good idea. You know, because the internet is the internet, the winning name was Bodhi McBoatface. It was originally suggested by BBC radio presenter James Hand, and he said he was inspired by Hootie McOwlface, which was, of course, an owl from an Adopt a Bird fundraiser, which had also been named in an online poll that went viral back in 2012. But while Bodhi McBoatface captured a full 33% of the vote, with the second place name taking only 11%, the British government at the time decided they weren't having it. Instead, the Minister for Universities and Science, Joe Johnson, announced shortly after the polls closed that this was cute and all, but the ship would in fact be named the Sir David Attenborough.
Boo. Oh, well, okay, hold on. That one's okay.
Yeah, yo, you're
right,
conflicted.
That's tough. Yeah. Like, no. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Okay, I see what you did there, you clever.
But as a consolation prize, they said, and in recognition of the fact that this stunt had indeed raised quite a lot of public awareness, they would go ahead and assign the name Bodhi McBoatface to one of the six small submersibles associated with the main ship, which, to your point, was deeply unsatisfying for most people. There was a big uproar.
Yeah, it's a submersible, so it's not a boat.
Right, exactly. It doesn't make any sense, but they were like, listen, we got to throw these people something.
It should have been
riot.
Donkey McDunkface.
There you go. Right. But in the end, Bodhi McBoatface is real and has been quietly doing research ever since.
Yay.
Now, fast forward to 2025. Bodhi was recently doing a test dive in the deep, cold waters of Loch Ness in Scotland.
Uh-oh.
I know. There's a lot of elements to this. I told you. And the reason that Bodhi was in Loch Ness is because it's actually a very geographically interesting lake, because it sits on top of the British Isles' most prominent tectonic fault. So Bodhi's got a lot of sensitive instruments on it. They were looking to get some data for a new study of some kind, when instead, something became tangled in Bodhi's propellers. So they carefully pulled her back up and discovered a bait line connected to a thick plastic cylinder. And when they opened that up, they discovered a 1970 Instamatic camera with an inbuilt flash cube in perfect condition.
What?
So perfect, in fact, that they were able to develop the film inside it.
What?
Now,
wow.
Sadly, there were no underwater monsters in the photos, just some basic shots of the lake bed. I know. But they were nonetheless able to identify who the camera belonged to. It was apparently placed at the bottom of the lake in 1970 by a biologist at the University of Chicago named Roy Mackle, who, despite his academic credentials, was absolutely convinced that Nessie was real and was hoping to prove it. And he had actually placed quite a few of these cameras around the bottom of the lake with their bait lines connected to the trigger so that a series of four rapid photos would be taken right at the moment that something big enough pulled on the line. And it's not clear why he left this one camera down there, other than maybe he just lost track of it. Unfortunately, we'll never know, because Mackle passed away back in 2013. But the camera and its developed photos have now been turned over to the Loch Ness Center in the nearby village of Drumnadrochit, which is, according to the center's general manager, Nagina Ishak, quote, committed to helping continue the search and unveil the mysteries that lie underneath the water. Basically, it's in the Nessie Museum is where it is. And everybody's
nice.
Very happy.
But no Loch Ness monster.
Oh, not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. I mean, you know, 1970s cameras.
Right. Or at least they're keeping that a secret.
That's right. I feel like you could get a GoPro down there nowadays and just get 100% footage under the water at all times.
Oh,
but then you'd be like, oh, well, the light is scaring Nessie away. That's why she won't come out.
Mm.
I assume it's a she. She's got to be a she, right?
Mm-hmm.
Surely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link. All right, from Science Alert, scientists discover a simple method to reduce mercury levels in tuna.
Oh.
Yeah. Best of all, it's a packaging tweak.
Hmm.
Oh, so it's not getting rid of the mercury in the fish.
Oh, no. This is not an environmental fix. This is just an
Got
individual
it.
Human fix like we like. You know, come
Got
on.
It.
Okay.
So
we'll get there. We'll get there. For now, here's what the team from the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences and Chalmers University of Technology experimented with. They added an amino acid called cysteine to canned tuna. And canned tuna is one of the types of tinned fish that is known for having the most mercury in it. The novel solution removed 25 to 35% of the mercury from the fish.
Well, so now it's just liquid mercury in the can. You gotta not drink the liquid?
It's more like liquid mercury absorber. So it's like a silica gel, but liquid, which may confuse the metaphor somewhat.
Right.
So, okay, let's see if we can get into the science of it. Cysteine was picked for the solution because of the way mercury strongly binds to it. It's like a magnet for mercury. That's actually how it's able to build up in fish in the first place, because it's an amino acid. Fish already got it. So they were thinking this might allow some of the mercury to be drawn out and instead bind to the solution so it can be discarded. But further research is needed to take care of the removed mercury, because I'm guessing just dumping it down the sink is going to...
Yeah, we're just going to put it back in the ocean.
Yeah, but hey, not in your body. What really matters, right?
Right.
Right, humans? So if you have been eating fish without any knowledge of any potential mercury contamination, if this is the first you're hearing of it, it's okay. You don't have to worry. You're unlikely to be consuming enough of it for there to be a danger. If you're doing it every day, I don't know.
Right. Why are you doing that?
Well, just stop.
Get some diversity in your diet, y'all. But if you are pregnant, you are recommended against eating really any of it. Young children, just eat a limited amount. But in most cases, the health benefits of eating fish overall just outweighs potential health risks. But if we could find a way to reduce those mercury levels in fish, we could get an additional risk reduction. And the beauty of this type of packaging is that it is active while the product is on the shelf. So they wouldn't have to actually change any production steps. There were no noticeable changes in the appearance or smell of the fish treated with cysteine. The mercury removal continued for up to 2 weeks. They did not need any extra additives for the solution to work. And the team thinks the methods outlined could be improved in the future.
Well, and it feels like it's something where if they're like, this definitely works, we put cysteine in the liquid in the can, you could also maybe do a preemptive soak where you do your 2 weeks with cysteine, throw that out, put fresh cysteine water in, and maybe get more benefit. So it feels like this is at least opening the door to something
exactly
even better.
That's what they're thinking. And maybe they find a disposal waste method where all of your like fishy cysteine water gets refined to make thermometers or something. What
there
else
you
uses
go.
Mercury? Right, like
fish thermometers.
There's got to be a way, I believe. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from livescience.com. It's a very important public interest article titled New Urinal Designs Could Prevent Up to 265,000 Gallons of Urine from Spilling Onto the Floor Each Day.
Huzzah!
Wow. That is a lot of urine to be spilling onto the floor.
Doing the Lord's
y'all.
Work, science.
So scientists say, thousands of gallons of ill-aimed pee could be spared from lavatory floors thanks to a new urinal design. Around 1 million liters, or 264,172 gallons, to be precise, of urine are spilled onto the floor and walls of public restrooms each day in the U.S. thanks to current urinal shapes creating hygiene issues and unpleasant smells. But now, in a new study published in the journal PNAS Nexus, scientists have... I
mean, come on.
The journal, I do not believe, is strictly about this topic.
No, it isn't. It's just too perfect.
It's been around for a while, y'all. So, urinals have not changed much since they started becoming popular in 19th century Europe as part of growing public health reforms in fast-growing cities. There are now around 56 million public restrooms across the U.S. alone, and the researchers wrote in the study, urinals are a staple of public spaces, yet their designs have remained essentially stagnant for over a century. The use of urinals often results in significant splatter, in parentheses, splashback, as urine splashes upon impact with the urinal generating droplets, which travel back onto the floor and the user. This splashback is a breeding ground for bacteria, resulting in bad smells in public restrooms and the potential for the spread of diseases. The researchers added the surfaces of urinals have significantly higher concentrations of bacteria than traditional toilets, with surrounding floors having the highest level. The high level of spillage of urine requires frequent cleaning, which uses a large volume of water, is unpleasant for custodial staff, and is very expensive. Some bathrooms attempt to reduce splashback using urinal screens, mats, or even stickers to tell people where to aim their urine. Ugh. The use of such stickers at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport was found to reduce splashback by between 50 and 80% and lower cleaning costs by 8%.
Wow, that's some user error in the whole problem, isn't it? Boy.
Sort of. It's also design error, too, and not being clear where to go.
Right, yeah. The little bullseye should have been part of the design from the get-go, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the funniest, urinal decorations I've ever seen was like a miniature soccer goal with a soccer ball hanging from a string in the goal, and it's just like right there in the center of the urinal.
Oh, but the string.
Yeah.
Make it fishing line, something nice and waterproof.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it was some synthetic plastic string or whatever, but yeah, let me tell you, there was an incentive to stay in the goal. Anyways, so to resolve these problems, the team created a fluid physics model of how a stream of liquid splashes when it hits a surface like the back of a urinal, and experimentally tested these methods by spraying liquid at surfaces at various angles. They mimicked a stream of urine by creating a pseudo-urethra nozzle, which had the same internal geometry as a human urethra, and used dyed liquid to better determine where splashback was occurring. They found that when the urine stream hit the surface at less than 30 degrees, the level of splashback was reduced to only 1.4% of the levels seen in a traditional urinal design. They used these models to design two new urinal shapes, which they dubbed cornucopia and nautilus. And there is a photo here. So the cornucopia is kind of like a large, basically your standard urinal, except it kind of has a sloping shape towards the back. And then there's only a big triangle opening. And the nautilus is more like, it really looks like an extremely deep-seated chair that's very tall, if that makes sense, where you're just going to have to look it up or use your imagination after that point. But basically, it's very clear that they're focusing on, you know, what areas urine and splashback would go into. So these designs both achieved a significant reduction in urine splashing, with the cornucopia performing best. However, the Nautilus was considered the most ideal design due to its height, which would allow shorter people, including children or those in wheelchairs, to more easily use it. Its larger gape would also be easier to clean and would be more accepting of poor aim, and therefore would also be appropriate for use on boats or airplanes. Assuming that the volume of water needed to clean up spilled urine is about 10 times that of the volume of urine, about 10 million liters of fresh water could be saved every day, the scientists said.
Well, and you know, on the flip side, if you've got 56 million toilets already in existence, what do you do with all of them? Well, you put them in the dump. But, you know, over time, as a urinal naturally reaches the end of its life cycle, you could put in one of these new ones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we just have to bring back the modern art trend of using urinals. And, like, we'll all just have our own personal urinal that we put our own name on.
Carry it around with you.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be a centerpiece in the house.
They should look into, like, paint by numbers. So it's like a Mona Lisa just emerges over the course of an evening.
Or y'all could all sit down. Like, just throw that option out there. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Undying Unicorn, Booze Makes Male Fruit Flies More Attractive to Females, and Invasion of the Home Humanoid Robots. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.